Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. At the core of that war these days, of course, is something that has eluded altogether too many of us in terms of really understanding its nature and the extent to which it must be confronted rather better than we've done to date. Our guest in this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio is going to help me explore Islamic totalitarianism, the term he is using as part of a new book on the subject entitled Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, From George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond. He is Elan Jurno. His co-author of that book is Ankar Gatte. He is also the editor of another terrific book entitled Winning the Unwinnable War, America's Self-Crippled Response to Islamic Totalitarianism. Elan is a fellow and director of policy research at the Ayn Rand Institute. You can find his writings in all the right places, notably Middle East Quarterly, The Federalist, FoxNews.com, Foreign Policy, and on and on. We're delighted to welcome back and thank him for giving us a full hour of his time to talk about these and related issues in depth. Elan, thank you. Good to have you back.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
Well, let me start at the beginning, I guess. Elan, you've brought forward this concept that what we're up against is Islamic totalitarianism. Others have described it alternately as, terrorism or violent extremism or some jihadism. Give us your working definition of Islamic totalitarianism and why you think that term is most apt.
I regard the enemy as defined by its ultimate goals, not by its means. And I think that's the way to approach any enemy, and that's how we approached it in the past. If you think about World War II, we didn't call the Japanese kamikazeists, and we didn't call the Nazis U-boatists or whatever it was their favorite tactic was. We called them by the ideology that animated their pursuit of a certain goal, and the goal was at the core of that ideology. With Islamic totalitarianism, I think that name is apt, and there might be a better name, but this one captures, I think, the essence of the movement, because what they are seeking is to reshape society wherever they can exert power and authority. And they have told us many times, and quite openly, which is part of the scandal of how we haven't really understood them, that what they want is a world that is in total shaped by their interpretation of Islamic religious law, Sharia. And what's significant here is that it spans different interpretations. So it's both Shia and Sunni sects of it there you can find, and it comes from different countries, and there are different groups, and there are factions, and they fight against each other. And I mention that because it's important to not be drawn into, well, Al-Qaeda and ISIS hate each other. Al-Qaeda disowned ISIS, so that there's clearly not one movement. There's lots of splinter groups. That's not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is to zoom out and see what is the common goal, even if certain factions and certain leaders fight each other, because that's typical to any ideological movement. You can find it among the communist movement. So I think Islamic totalitarianism is a key way to capture that.
Let me ask you what you would describe as the goals of Islamic totalitarianism.
Sure. So, good examples of what it looks like are the Taliban regime pre-2001, ISIS today, Iran today, Saudi Arabia today. Now, a lot of people would balk at that because they'll say, wait. You can go to Iran and be a tourist and look around, and that's great. But you would never go to pre-2001 Afghanistan. But essentially, they differ only in certain degrees. Now, what do they have in common? It's a society where the law is defined by religious adherence to their interpretation of Sharia. And that means that in every particular, at least this is what the state tries to do, is to enforce specific detailed laws about how you live your life, whom you may marry, what you may do in your marriage, how you can earn money and what kind of work you can't do. You can't lend out money unless it's according to certain religious doctrines. You can't not pray 5 times a day. You can't avoid fasting at Ramadan, or you will be punished by people enforcing the law. They have morality police. So it's a way of having a kind of moral view of the world that is enforced politically as an all-consuming system. And it is one more thing to mention, if we're just going to give kind of a snapshot, is that this is inherently an expansionist or imperialist doctrine. In other words, it seeks to expand the realm under its authority by conquest. And that doesn't always mean war, but it means trying to grab more people and subjugate them. So it's inherently an oppressive system.
Let me just drill down on some of this, because you've given us so much food for thought. There are those who say Sharia is only partially, really, about religious practice, and that the vast majority of it involves, well, the kinds of things you've just talked about, governance of all aspects of life. I kind of think of it as basically being about power, whether it's, you know, within your family unit or with your neighbors or with your business associates or with, you know, the various rulers, ultimately, you know, governing the world, really. Is that how you see it? And if so, does that sort of contribute to the confusion about what it is we're up against? Because, as recently as last night in the debate between the vice presidential candidates, the proposition kept cropping up that this is all really about a religion.
I think it's rooted in the religion without question. So I think every jihadist group and every jihadist professes to be a Muslim, but it's certainly not all Muslims. And I think it needs to be said that not all Muslims are our enemies. That's far from the truth. But I think it's critical to see that the nature of the problem is this is a movement that seeks obedience by force, and obedience as in bowing to authority and politically. And it's also a movement that stems from a culture that has had no meaningful separation of religion from state, from temporal power. And so the doctrines are wedded so that it's a comprehensive way of life that doesn't separate what politics looks like from what religion is. It's one and the same. They roll together. So if you're a good person, you live under a good government, and a good government is one defined by Sharia. And that means obedience to Allah and obedience to his temporal representatives. And that's both a historical fact of the kind of societies that have flourished under this kind of regime. And it's a fact that in many respects, as I understand the doctrines, they call for that kind of unity. Why separate out government from religion? Why separate out morality from politics? So there's definitely an integration between them, which doesn't deny the fact that there are people who are faithful Muslims and who are peaceful and who don't seek a society that is like that. Now, there's questions that for scholars of Islam to debate about what does that really mean, and what kind of interpretation is that? A mainstream interpretation? Is that a kind of reform perspective? Who is actually being more true to the doctrine? But that's a scholarly exegetical kind of debate that doesn't really concern us if we're trying to understand the nature of the enemy, because the enemy is the core of the problem. And what we do understand about them is that it's rooted in this religion that takes religion and politics to be one, and they seek our subjugation and death.
Very explicitly, as you say, Alain Journeau, this is not something that is concealed from us or that is hard to ascertain based upon the writings and the speeches, to say nothing of the behavior of many of those who are at the leading edge of this enemy phalanx. Ilan Giorno is our guest for this full hour of conversation about Islamic totalitarianism and our failure to confront it. We will talk more with Ilan about the various, interpretations and what their implications are for us with regard to Sharia. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest for this hour is Ilan Giorno. He is the co-author with Ankar Gate of a very important, very thoughtful, very timely book entitled Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism from George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond. He is the fellow and director of policy research at the Ayn Rand Institute and has been a guest once before, but we're very pleased to have him back for a more in-depth conversation about the topic that he has addressed in this book and others. Let me ask you, Ilan, about this issue of Sharia. I think you've characterized it very well as kind of at the core of the ideology and the thing that is driving the goals of Islamic totalitarianism. There are those who say there are different kinds of Sharia and that one shouldn't be unduly concerned about the specific claims being made by, say, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, because he's just following one interpretation. And as you said in the previous segment, there are peaceful Muslims who are following their own, and they're clearly not a problem. Tease that out with us, if you would. Is there more than one kind of Sharia in the Islamic tradition, the mainstream tradition I'm talking about here, or are we really looking at the same corpus of law, if you will, just enforced to varying degrees in different places throughout the Muslim world?
So I should say my expertise is not Islamic scholarship, but I have looked into it. So that, with that qualification, I would say you will find different schools of jurisprudence within Islam and within the different major sects. And there's two perspectives you can take. From the inside of the religion, I'm sure that people would insist and they would make a strong case that our view is very different from those people over there. You know, we have certain ways of looking at things that are very different. In the same way that if you look at Christian denominations, the Catholic and various Protestant sects look at things very differently from the inside. Now, those are interesting questions, and they're important from certain perspectives. But from our perspective, on the outside looking at this, what matters is when we think of the Islamic totalitarian movement, the one question to ask is, does it have roots in the religion of Islam and the history and the tradition and the and things like that? So like the whole tradition of an empire and conquest, different denominations, different sects and the different jurisprudence schools. But on the outside, from our perspective of thinking this as a national security issue, not as a theological one, the question to ask is, can we understand this ideology without seeing its important roots in the history and doctrines of Islam and just the model of Muhammad as a conqueror who is both a political and religious leader? And the answer is no, we can't. And if you look at the doctrines of Islamic totalitarianism, and when you boil them to their kind of common denominator, the kind of society they want, how they want to achieve it, there are commonalities, and it does follow from sort of an outside perspective on Islam as a doctrine. And by that I mean this. It would be strange if the Islamic totalitarians told us that we must bow in the name of Zeus and Aphrodite. That would definitely be a non-mainstream interpretation of Islamic doctrine. But they don't tell us that. Yeah, they don't tell us that. And they don't tell us we have to bow in the name of Moses. They tell us that we have to bow in the name of Allah. And they tell us that they're modeling themselves on Muhammad in very specific ways, and this is one of the things ISIS has done, and they model themselves on this on what is easily traceable, and it's a natural interpretation. Now, I'm not going to take a stand and say this is the only interpretation that makes sense, and that we have to discount all the others as non-Muslims, because that's a debate that Iran and Saudi Arabia have every day: who's more Muslim, and are you a Shiite or are you a Sunni, and who's a heretic? And it, from their perspective, that's very significant. From our perspective, it is not. Because what matters is, what really animates the people who are blowing themselves up in the streets of Paris and in the streets of Ankara and in the streets of New York, and who would want to blow up things in New York? Now, it is a certain doctrine that is a political movement, ideological movement, rooted in this ideology and in this religion. And that's significant. We have to understand that if we hope to stop them.
Yeah. You know, Ilan, I think you've really said that as well as can be said. The one fillip that I would add is it seems to me that as long as this is reflected in authoritative Islam, not just sort of heretical, you know, factions, it greatly exacerbates the problem you're describing. You know, it's bad enough if it's just an Islamic State here or an Al-Qaeda there or a Taliban someplace else or a Boko Haram or a Hamas or a Hezbollah. I mean, that's a serious national security problem all by itself. But if potentially many, many millions of other Muslims are persuaded that this Mohammedan model, as you mentioned, this doctrine of Sharia as practiced by the authorities of Al-Azhar and, you know, the Saudis and the like, are in fact the true teachings of the faith. Clearly, that's at least an incipient and far larger problem than the various outcroppings of it in these terrorist groups that I've mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, let me just add something to that, because I think there's a perspective on this that's important, which is, if you recall, after the 2005 suicide bombings on the London Underground, there was a famous survey, opinion poll of Muslims in the UK. And the result of it, and the basic question that a lot of people were alarmed by is, would you support taking such actions against the UK and other Western countries? I think that was the way the issue was framed. And an astonishing number said yes, and it was, in a sense, taken to mean there's a certain sympathy with what was done, though not a willingness to do it themselves. And there have been other polls in the years since, both about people's perspective on Al-Qaeda and so on. And what's surprising there is that whether or not they themselves would regard their views as we're Islamic totalitarians, or just I'm a regular Muslim and this is my view, there's an alarming number who either have sympathy for the goal that Islamic totalitarians have, or at least believe that however bad their means, what they're trying to do is in some sense noble. Now, I don't remember the poll offhand right now. I don't have it in front of me, but people can look this up. I think one of the most recent ones was a Pew survey And it's troubling because it means that there's a certain resonance, at least, by the people who have peaceful lives but who espouse a certain view of Islam and their view of these actions. Now, that doesn't mean that's not something you can draw very strong conclusions about, but it's a very important fact that you need to understand, as there's a certain constituency that has resonance and sometimes sympathy and more, perhaps, than they might tell in the surveys. But that's real data to chew on and understand is, okay, what are we really looking at? Is it just a fringe ragtag group of people, or is there wider resonance for this ideology?
Well, and again, this is what I keep calling us back to is, without getting into the various sectarian divides and fissures and fault lines and the rest, there is this common belief that within, you know, sort of the so-called mainstream Islam, that jihad is an obligation. And it's not just personal struggle. It is about bringing about the triumph of Sharia worldwide. And in keeping with the Muslim practice, Muhammad's model, doing it through violence where you can and through stealthy means where you can't. Which brings us to the question of the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in all of this. And we'll talk about that with Ilan Giorno and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Obama Justice Department has intervened yet again to help Hillary Clinton win in November. Evidently, it's not content with protecting the Democratic presidential candidate against prosecution for her compromise of classified information or the corrupt abuse of the Office of Secretary of State to enrich her family and its charitable foundation. The department just prevented the disclosure of documents that would likely have exposed Mrs. Clinton's role in the disastrous decision to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi and arm his jihadist opponents. As a result, years of politically motivated prosecution of Mark Turi, a man wrongly accused of gun-running to Libya, has come to an abrupt end. That's good news for Mr. Turi. It's bad news for voters who will shortly have to evaluate the fitness of a potential commander-in-chief on the basis of spin rather than her actual record of malfeasance. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for the third segment of this important conversation with an extraordinarily informed and thoughtful observer of the nature and menace of Islamic totalitarianism. He is Ilan Giorno with the Ayn Rand Institute. We're talking a bit about his newest book, Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, but also drawing upon some of the insights in an important companion piece that he wrote in 2009, edited in 2009, entitled Winning the Unwinnable War, America's Self-Crippled Response to Islamic Totalitarianism. Ilan, I want to really walk through a facet of this larger problem that is almost entirely unremarked. I mean, you get it, I think, and have helped shed light on it, but for example, in the course of the conversation last night between Senator Tim Kaine and Governor Mike Pence, the vice presidential candidates, respectively, for the Democrats and the Republican Party, there was nary a mention of the problem of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I would just ask you to talk a little bit about this group, what it represents in terms of this, you know, sort of global totalitarian jihadist movement, including in our own country.
So the Muslim Brotherhood is probably one of the oldest Islamic totalitarian movements, organizations that we know of. It started in the 1920s in Egypt, as some of your listeners well know, I think. And it was a really powerful movement in the sense, not that it achieved any of its immediate goals in the first 90 years or so of its existence. But I think they came close in Egypt after the Arab Spring. But in that it was an intellectual fount, and many groups spun off from it. And it managed to build a network throughout the Middle East of chapters, some of which we know today because they've become very, very powerful and dangerous. So Hamas was a spinoff from the Muslim Brotherhood chapter in the Palestinian territories. One of the groups that is also notorious is some of the groups that formed Al-Qaeda originated as parts of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, it's important to see that the spinoffs were often by people who felt that the Muslim Brotherhood's agenda was too slow, it was too incremental, it was too focused on cultural change for the long term, because they played the long game. And the people who spun off basically said, well, we need to be more active. Look at what they managed to do in 1979 in Iran. The fighters for jihad succeeded in overtaking that country. We need to act and act now. And there's that kind of spirit of activism and the need to take up arms sooner rather than later. And that's important to see that we need to take violence to the streets at some point. But when are we ready?
How is that translated in practice, that kind of jihad? I think they call it civilization jihad in countries in the West, including our own.
So I think the best model to look at, and I think what they hope to replicate, is what they did in Egypt and elsewhere, and then I'll talk about the West. So it was essentially cultivating a group of people, a culture or a subgroup, and then widely the whole culture so that people accept the ideas in their own lives through indoctrination and education and just acculturation, so that by the time there's a need to call a revolution or just to seal the deal, in effect, most people in the culture are ready for it. Now, I understand that this has not been a focus of my research, that part of their goal is to do that beyond where they have chapters and perhaps even in the West, and to kind of infiltrate and do subversion and so forth. This is a field you know more about, but I understand that, and I wouldn't discount it. I think it's important to understand that the only way that can succeed fundamentally is not because they're wily, but because we aren't paying attention. And we aren't scrutinizing the people that we're holding up as experts on Islam acting. So there are all kinds of stories of the last 15 years of advisors and trainers to the FBI and the CIA who, in effect, are put up as, well, these guys are normal, great people, they're on our side, they're helping. But in fact, if you look at their statements and their actions, they're very sympathetic to the enemy. And that's a problem, though. To me, it's startling that they can gain authority and positions of training and instructorship of law enforcement, and yet be so sympathetic to the enemy. So to me, that's another telling sign of how little we understand them, and not just their tactics and the idea that they can subvert from it within, but just the very idea of, well, how do you know if someone's on your side? How do you know what their stand is? And to me, that's significant.
It is enormously significant. And in fact, Ilan Giorno, this is a subject that the Center for Security Policy has focused a lot of time and effort on. In fact, we have an entire series of monographs that we've published, which I commend to you as well as to our listeners. They're available for free online as PDFs at securefreedom.org. We call them the Civilization Jihad Reader Series, a name that derives from this extraordinary book I'm sure you're familiar with called The Explanatory Memorandum, a secret plan that the U.S. government introduced in evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history back in 2008, and used it to convict people associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think setting the stage for prosecuting a whole bunch more. Alas, that didn't happen. For reasons, among others, that you've sort of alluded to, the extent to which we've taken counsel and guidance about what we can know and see and do about all of this from people who are, in fact, Muslim Brotherhood operatives or at least aligned with them. I guess this is really the crux of the matter. One of the things that, as you know, has been very much a feature of the Islamist agenda has been to prevent what they call Sharia blasphemy, which would be things, expression, videos, speeches, written articles, what have you. I dare say your books and writings, most certainly, that offend Muslims. And I'd just ask you to talk a little bit about if indeed, as you say, we've had a failure under successive administrations, Republican and Democratic, to understand, let alone effectively to confront Islamic totalitarianism, whether that silencing of us in the name of avoiding giving offense might be a contributing factor.
It is a huge factor. I think it's way understated, and people don't really appreciate what we're facing here with the attacks on free speech, because they're just the tip of the spear for what I regard as the essential agenda, which is people recall the cartoon crisis of 2005, 2006 with Danish cartoons and the uproar that caused, and one of the publications that reprinted those cartoons was Charlie Hebdo. And of course, in 2015, the editorial offices of Charlie Hebdo were attacked and the editorial staff massacred. What people don't understand is that this isn't about offense. This is about elevating their perspective on the world, their Islamic totalitarian agenda, and saying, no, you mustn't live according to the principle of free speech, which means that every ideology is subject to criticism and ridicule, and you might not like that. You have to live with it. That's what a free society looks like. No, you mustn't live by that principle. You must live by a higher principle. That means the doctrines of Sharia, which say blasphemy is bad. And blasphemy, by the way, as it was in the medieval times in Europe under the church and today, is a subjective term. What does it really mean to blaspheme except to offend the people in power who want to subjugate you? So the attacks on free speech, which are significant, are part of this idea that we have to elevate certain religious dicta above the Constitution, above the First Amendment, above free speech as a principle, a moral principle. And what I would highlight here is that this has succeeded in the examples we've seen lately and the cartoon crisis from about 10 years ago, and even before that with the fatwa on the life of the author Salman Rushdie. These only succeed because we in the West have crumpled. We have not stood up for our own principles, and that has only encouraged them.
We have to pause for another moment, and when we come back, I want to talk about that that phenomenon, why we're doing it, and what it's signaling to our adversaries in the Islamic totalitarian or global jihadist movement. That and more with the Lam Journal. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're talking with Ilan Giorno, the co-author of Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, From George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond. Also the editor of another important book, Winning the Unwinnable War. And Ilan, one of the things that has made this war, unwinnable, to use your term, I think, has been the extent to which we have this practice of political correctness, is a term that's favored. Some people call it diversity sensitivity or multiculturalism or just not wanting to give offense or to appear being racist or bigoted or Islamophobic. But I wondered if you would agree with me that whatever we call it, however we rationalize it or justify it or dress it up, the enemy has a different term for it, different way of seeing it, and that is as submission. And if you would, what are the implications of them perceiving our behavior in that fashion?
I think it's crucial to see that in the widest sense of their goal, what they're trying to fashion is a society that is dominated by religious law. And that means that the people who are subjugated by it are submitting, are bowing to authority and surrendering their own minds and giving up control of their lives and sacrificing their freedom, basically, all the rights that we take for granted in this country. So if that's the perspective of, that's a test of success for them, to the extent that people submit to their doctrines and their control, that is an index for them of how well they're doing. And I think you mentioned the issue of the attacks on free speech, which I think are super significant and require people's commitment and understanding to see how significant they are. I think it is evidence that we're submitting and we're bowing to them. And I would say that one of the things I talk about in the earlier book that you mentioned, Winning the Unwinnable War, is I go into a little depth on the Western reactions to the cartoon crisis of 2005, 2006. And one of the things that you see is the European leaders in particular, and even George W. Bush, they went out of their way to apologize. It is not their place to apologize for what journalists do. To apologize and beg forgiveness and promise that there'll be better safeguards. And there's no way to look at that and say that they're not submitting to the demands of the people who created this crisis and who want us to surrender our principle of freedom of speech and, in effect, bow to the idea that you mustn't blaspheme against Islam, which is, I think there's all sorts of things to say about how much nonsense that is, but you can't look at that from the outside and say, oh yeah, they're not submitting, they're not bowing to it, because that's exactly what we did and that's what we continue to do. And part of what's so horrifying about this is now the things have gotten so bad here in the West is that we're attacking the people who are willing to speak up and criticize the ideology of Islamic totalitarianism, allowing them to be branded Islamophobic, which is, I don't accept that term, it's a smear. And so, you know, if you recall, there are lots of incidents, and one of my colleagues, Steve Simpson, has written a book called Defending Free Speech that tracks a lot of these instances of blaming the victims now, which is, what more could you want if your goal is to make us submit, that we're now attacking the people who are not submitting?
Really, the crux of the problem, it seems to me, is dangerous as the foreign violent jihad is, at the core of the threat posed to our country by Islamic totalitarianism, to use your term, is our failure to even allow ourselves to talk about it accurately, which is, of course, is the precursor to disabling us from doing anything else about it. And let me just ask you, you, of course, as I've mentioned, hail from the Ayn Rand Institute, an entity that I think has helped carry forward sort of a libertarian intellectual tradition. I find this very refreshing, what you're saying, to be honest, because typically, in my experience, the response of many in the sort of, if I may call it, the libertarian community has been, well, look, we'll leave them alone. They'll leave us alone. We're not going to tell them what to think or say, and we just want to be able to, you know, do our own thing. And yet, what you've described here, Ilan Giorno, is a very, I think, clear-eyed appreciation. It doesn't work that way when you're dealing with totalitarians. Would you sort of address that sort of intellectual tradition and how it must be brought to sort of an understanding of what we're really up against now?
Yeah, I think the purpose of our government is to protect our individual rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So it's our government's responsibility as well to uphold the freedom of speech and, of course, to defend us from foreign threats. And I believe that it has failed to do that for ideological, philosophic reasons. We don't have an understanding of the enemy and we don't feel we have a right to defend ourselves. And the people who say if we just ignore it, it'll go away and don't bother them, they won't bother us. That trades, and I'm not imputing this view to everyone, but often it trades on a mistaken understanding of American foreign policy, because that's a big account. You know, American foreign policy went around and created this problem. That is not the way to see it. The problem is we failed for many decades to understand the nature of the Middle East as an area we fail to understand the ideology that's rising and ascendant in that area, and that there's a movement that seeks to obliterate freedom everywhere. And to me, you can't, if you take our lives seriously, you have to defend against that. That's the purpose of government, and it's a failure of government not to do that. So there's all kinds of things packed into the idea of we can ignore it and it'll go away, and it doesn't. I mean, the history leading up to 9/11, the years and months leading up to that were a farce of pretending that we're doing something and not really understanding who we're up against and what they're trying to do. And that didn't make them go away. That made them come back with a force, because every time we appear to be weak and submissive, and we did appear weak and submissive for many decades, that only encourages them. And we've seen that for the last 15 years in particular. And that's part of what the books I've written document.
One of the things that I keep calling people's attention to is that this isn't exactly an accident. In fact, one of the central tenets of the Quran, as you know, is that it's not enough to obtain the infidel's submission through jihad to Sharia and this totalitarian program. You must make them, in the words of the Quran, feel subdued. By which I believe it's meant that the infidel, the submitting dhimmi, or whatever you might call him, is to understand there will never be another state. They will always be, you know, enslaved or you know, worse, dead at the hands of their supremacist Sharia adherent Islamic. This is the thing that is so frightening to me as I look at the mistakes that we've been making that are so well chronicled in your books about our failure to understand and confront Islamic totalitarianism, is that far from actually attenuating the danger we're facing by trying to be accommodating or giving no offense or being politically correct or sensitive or whatever you want to call it. When they see that submission, they are actually doctrinally required to redouble the effort to make us feel subdued. And that, I'm afraid, means more jihad, and particularly of the violent kind, not less. Ilan Jorna, we'll be right back with one last segment, and we're going to talk about, so what do we do, given where we are now, given the condition we've put ourselves in, how do we confront and defeat this Islamic totalitarianism? That and more with Ilan Jorna right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. The final installment of this very informative conversation with Ilan Jorna, a man who's given a lot of thought and considerable intellectual capability has been brought to bear by him and his co-author Anke Gatte about the phenomenon of Islamic totalitarianism and the threat that it poses to all of us if it is not effectively countered. Let's turn in this final few minutes to what you would prescribe, given the various problems that we've discussed and their manifestations and the challenges that are entailed even in talking about this, as you have done, let alone doing something effective about it. What would you recommend to be done to counter effectively this threat?
I and my colleagues have been making this case for about 15 years. And I'll keep making it because I think it's the right way to go. It's in the books you mentioned. And it's basically that we need to take military action. And I say that with a big proviso, which is it doesn't look like the Iraq or Afghanistan campaigns, which were essentially nation-building efforts and really went awry and were bad from the conception, which is part of what the books articulate. I mean a war that is properly defined with a goal that is achievable, and it has to target the leading state sponsors of Islamic totalitarianism and then cascade to as far as we have to do. So I think you start with an ultimatum to Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and particularly now that we've allowed this to happen, the Islamic State has to be part of that focus. And it has to be that you must stop being the world's most active state sponsor of terrorism, Iran. You must stop being the world's most active proselytizer for this cause, Saudi Arabia. And if that isn't enough, and it might be that we have to prove ourselves yet again, but we take military action. Now, when I say that, people are going to scoff and they're going to roll their eyes, and understandably, because nobody wants to echo Obama. Nobody wants another Middle East war, which means another quagmire like Iraq. And that's not what I'm advocating. If that was the option, I wouldn't choose it. But I think what you need to do is demonstrate our willingness to defeat the enemy and then defeat the enemy because our lives matter and we are worth it. And once you do that, once you take the state sponsors out of the equation, including Islamic State, once you take them out of the equation, what you're trying to do and what you demonstrate is that this cause is lost. And all those people who gravitate to it because they want to fight and die for this ideology will rethink it and then stop a lot of them in their tracks. And that's ultimately how you defeat an ideological movement like Islamic totalitarianism. I go into a lot more depth in the books, but this is the crux. There's no way to end this unless you take military action. And I'm afraid that having tried and failed, people have come to the conclusion that military action is ineffective. And that's a misconception. That's an injustice to the military. What happened is a policy failure because we ultimately didn't know what we were going after. Why Iraq versus Iran? I mean, Iran is much more clearly central to the Islamic totalitarian movement than Iraq was. There's so many things that went wrong, so it's understandable that people recoil. But here we are, 15 years after 9/11, and the enemy isn't just around. It isn't just on the run. It is in force, and it's attracting people, and it's able to inflict harm. And this is a long-term problem unless we take serious action.
Ilan, this is such a crucial point. The idea that you must defeat this enemy, you must dissuade them from believing that it is, in fact, God's will that they will decisively defeat you, is an absolutely necessary condition. I'm wondering whether the use of military force is sufficient, however, even if the policy direction is right and the full effect of our military power can be brought to bear decisively, is it enough? Or are there other instruments of political power that also need to be marshaled? I, as you may know, a creature of Ronald Reagan's administration and helped in a small way with his use of really all instruments of national power against the former Soviet Union, the last totalitarian ideology that sought our destruction. And I wonder whether some of the techniques that he utilized, whether it's economic power, including, you know, going at the energy resources and wellspring of wealth of so many of these dangerous countries, whether it's political warfare, information operations, discrediting them, and such techniques, intelligence, of course, that also ought to be in the mix.
I would agree that there's a lot we can do. We have more than a Swiss Army knife. We have the world's most powerful military/intelligence infrastructure known to man, and I think we should use its full capacity and resources. But you do raise an important point that I want to highlight and really emphasize, which is that as part of taking the fight to the enemy, which I think is a necessary condition, and understanding who the enemy is, as part of doing that, it's not sufficient to go in and say, and it would be worse than that. It would be counterproductive to go in and, as we did, and say, we're going to defeat the enemy so that you guys can have elections. We're going to defeat the enemy so you guys can rebuild your society. That's not why we're going in. We're going in to defend ourselves and prevent this enemy from fighting and end it. And part of what we need to do, this speaks to sort of what falls under today the heading of public diplomacy, but I think of it more as stating our moral case. So in the Declaration of Independence, they were correct, I think people agree, in saying that in the course of human events, when you have to take significant action, you have to explain yourself. And we need to explain what we're doing and why, the moral justification for it. And this goes back to the issue of if we show that we understand them and what we're trying to do and emphasize that we know what you're trying to do and we're going to defeat you and you're going to lose and everyone is hearing that broadcast, that is incredibly powerful. As powerful as our submission is in encouraging them, our moral stand and our straightening up of our spine is incredibly powerful in making them back down. Because like a lot of bullies, the bravado, the braggadocio, all of that go away when there's some serious opposition. And that's why I think that the start of this doesn't even have to be a military effort. It just needs to be a significant military threat, not a red line that we then wipe off with our finger, but a real military ultimatum. And then you escalate as you need to, but you might not even need to if you have the right kind of messaging that is sincere and that we back up with action. So, you know, you mentioned Reagan. There's one thing I agree about his doctrine, part of what he did that I actually admire, and there's a lot of things to disagree with and agree with him, but one of the things he did is he spoke up in a way that people behind the Iron Curtain really understood, and it was incredibly motivating for them. If you think about the Polish opposition, they would say, and a lot of them have said this, that just the thought that he's on their side, just the thought he was against the communist totalitarian oppressors, that was enough to keep them going. Now, we would like to support better people in the Middle East, wherever they are and to whatever extent they can have influence. But more important is that the inverse of that is we want to deter the people who have malign goals. And a strong, powerful moral message about our own right to self-defense and our moral right to do it is going to be incredibly resonant if we do it right. So I would say it's not military action can't be taken without that because it's not going to be as effective.
A closing thought on that very important point, Ilan Jorno. One, Reagan talked about, going back to what I said at the outset, every generation facing an existential threat to freedom. And I think this is ours, our generation at the moment. Secondly, I would just say that I think your point about laying out the case for us and our determination to defend our civilization decisively is important not just with respect to foreign populations who are deciding whether to throw in with these Islamic totalitarians, but also for Muslims within our own country. Ilan Jorno, there is so much more to talk about, but we've done a fair bit of it today, and I think very helpfully so. Thank you for your time and for the important work you're doing at the Ayn Rand Institute. Come back to us again soon if you would, sir. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.